I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The continuing loss of manufacturing jobs in America seems inevitable. Some states fight the loss with tax incentives. Some communities are inventing a new high road approach to reclaim these jobs. Dan Swinney heads the Center for Labor and Community Research. A former union organizer, Dan is convinced that business and labor working together can not only save but create new manufacturing jobs. His approach may be radical, but it seems to be working, and we'll find out more about it today on Smart City. We'll also talk with Peter Fisher about how to grade the business climate, which ratings are useless, and which ones tell the real story. That's all coming up right after the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Dan Swinney heads the Center for Labor and Community Research, where he is attempting to build a new high road approach to manufacturing and retail in America. His collaborators are an unlikely coalition of business owners, labor unions, and community organizations. He began his career as a machinist and organized the Steelworkers Local at Gulf and Western's Taylor Forge in Cicero, Illinois. Is the death of manufacturing inevitable in this country?
You know, by no means. This country is, well, taking Chicago as an example, we've lost 4,000 out of 7,000 factories over the last 20 years, 200,000 basic manufacturing jobs. And to many people, you know, for good reason, that led to the conclusion, well, manufacturing is a thing of the past. It's going the way of agriculture. How can we compete with China? So on and so forth. Over the last 25 years, well, I was myself a machinist, and my plant closed. And I had personal experience with it, and I've also spent time looking at probably, you know, 100 or more manufacturing companies in the immediate area that faced a crisis that closed. And after looking at it, I'm convinced that 80% of those companies didn't need to close. I mean, they closed for reasons that could have been addressed by business, by labor, by government, by broader community. Some required some exotic solutions. Most, 90%, could have just sort of common sense solutions. You know, for example, we had probably 1,000 or 2,000 companies that closed simply because you had an aging owner with no successor in the company to take over the business. So when he retired, his kid didn't want to go into the ghetto to run the manufacturing company, or if he wanted to be in business, he stayed in, wanted to go to Harvard Business School to make money in stocks and bonds and not make money making a product. That company fell through the cracks because nobody knew about it. It closed. We've helped groups of employees buy those kinds of companies. We've helped entrepreneurs who are in the community buy those kinds of companies. You know, that's a problem that could be solved.
Solved on a big scale, Dan?
Yeah, solved on a big scale. This issue of succession of ownership, we did a study. I mean, it's a big problem that has a simple solution. We did a study of 800 small companies, found that 40% were at risk of closing only because of the issue of succession. So, you know, anticipating those kinds of problems, setting in motion mechanisms to provide either groups of employees. A lot of times these companies have 5, 10, 15 employees who've worked there for 20 or 25 years. They know the business. They know the customers. They know the technology. And they can be helped to arrange the financing, to hire a manager or become a manager themselves. Other companies, we've done, you know, a lot of an analysis of the issue of workforce training and education. You know, today's manufacturing jobs are not the jobs our parents had. I mean, these are jobs that require math skills, educational skills, computer skills. They involve robotics. They involve teamwork. In Chicago, we found, in the Cook County, we found there's 10,500 new jobs that have to be filled every year, yet in our education system, both in Chicago public schools and city colleges and training providers, hasn't provided enough people to fill the demand of companies for skilled workers that they need to compete. So right now, we're actually working on solutions to this problem, and people in those institutions now want to, in fact, upgrade their potential, their performance, so they can meet this capacity. But the absence of a good workforce training and education system has cost this region dearly, and has cost every region around the country dearly in terms of retaining its manufacturing base.
Tell me, though, there's a huge difference in wages between American wages and wages paid, let's say, in Southeast Asia.
Sure.
So how do American manufacturers, let's say if everything goes right, then how do they compete given wages are a significant portion of the, you know, expenses of any manufacturing company?
Well, I mean, when people think about manufacturing, you know, it's a general topic, but manufactured goods vary considerably. I mean, you have a ping pong ball, that's a manufactured good. You have a pair of pants or a pair of socks, that's a manufactured good. You have a robot, that's a manufactured good. You now have micro-machined tools that make gears that go inside the human body for medical technology. That's a manufactured product. So my perspective is, you know, I'm in fact in favor of industrial development throughout the world. I'm glad there's industrial development in China because, and I hope there'd be industrial development in the Middle East. Maybe we'd have less terrorism if we had more wealth that was spread more broadly. My view is there are some jobs that will go inevitably to countries that can compete with, that have very low wage rates. The question is, in my view, we should allow those jobs to go if we really can't compete based on wages and the cost of doing product. The question is, what are we going to do with today? And I think we should be looking at the kinds of products in manufacturing, like things related to robots, like things related to micro-machining, things that are high value added or complex machining or manufactured products that require sophistication, high technology, and actually require the kinds of strengths that we have in this country. Products that are complex, that have complex processes. And we should be gearing our education institution, our research institutions, our workforce, our business associations to learning how to compete more effectively in those niches. And no, that's going to be our future.
If transportation costs continue to rise, do we then develop a capability or a competitive advantage where we're serving an American market or a North American market with manufactured goods here and eliminating or reducing the transportation cost?
Yeah, no, that's a very important point. I mean, and it's important in two ways. I mean, you know, with the rise in price of oil, any goods now cost more to bring, you know, abroad. And so clearly, if, you know, we do a lot of work in the food industry, for example, in my organization. And so, you know, food is a local market, typically, and it's a niche market. And freshness is very important. And so, you know, companies that produce do, and in Chicago, we have 850 food manufacturers. And there is an advantage they have by being local and servicing local markets. There's also another trend, which is an emerging trend. It's called mass customization, where you have people who now want to buy, for example, one of the new hybrid cars. They want to go into a car dealership and they say, I want this quality, I want this feature, I want these kinds of locks, and I want it in 3 days. And that's a growing trend. That also gives the United States now, because we have consumers who have those kinds of expectations, not only with cars, but with computers, with all kinds of products. So our ability to now turn out a product in 3 or 4 days that meets the very specific needs of a customer is going to be an advantage for the people who sell those products, but it's also going to be an advantage for the people who make those products.
So as long as we remain a strong consumer market, there are manufacturing opportunities that relate to speed.
Absolutely. And Henry Ford made the point. You also want to then have a workforce that's paid well enough so it can buy the products that it creates, which is another argument for manufacturing. So now you have service sector and the retail sector who can't even afford to buy Walmart products, much less anything else.
We're going to come back to that. Okay. But I want to ask you about the Center for Labor and Community Research, the organization you founded. Tell me how you came to that organization and its mission.
I was an industrial worker who lost my job with the plant closing, and actually I'd worked for a small, not so small, family-owned company that was bought out by a big conglomerate, Gulf and Western, and they closed the company by their business strategy called milking the cash cow. That was in 1982, and at that point, you know, like I said, there's a hemorrhage of jobs in Chicago. In Cicero, where the company was, we lost 50% of our jobs in 6 years. Mm. I was also the leader of the Steelworkers Union, a local. I'd organized it in that shop. And you know, there is also this huge wave of plant closings that change every rule. I mean, the communities were changing. If you're a labor leader, every aspect of negotiations changed, became very complicated. So I created and founded the Center for Labor and Community Research to do this, first of all, the kind of in-depth analysis that would help anybody try to figure out what is going on. And actually, when we first formed, your first question was this change in manufacturing wasn't inevitable. And when you say inevitable, is the loss of manufacturing jobs is due to globalization, new technology, and therefore there's very little we can do about it. So when we formed the organization, we actually formed reacting to this crisis, and we didn't know whether or not this problem was inevitable, whether or not we could do anything about it. We did know the only way to find out if you can do anything about it is to look seriously into the problem. And so we are an organization that does micro-level research. We're not a sort of think tank in a traditional sense. We do a lot of in-depth analysis of particular companies. So as we did that kind of work, I know we did work in small companies and large companies on behalf of unions, of city government, of business associations, we quickly found that there was quite a bit that you could do. So as now as an organization, we view ourselves not so much as a reactive organization, but as an organization that has a development vision, a development model, with a specialty in working with manufacturing and working with promoting working relationships between business and labor on solving these kinds of problems.
You're unusual in that you came out of the labor movement,
right,
but you often represent manufacturers and their interest in this inquiry and what we do about it. So what attitudes or beliefs do the various sectors, labor and manufacturing, bring to this issue or this crisis, if you will, and, you know, their perspectives and how those perspectives are evolving to create something, a completely new relationship?
Well, as we looked in, you know, we saw these companies in crisis, and we saw, well, there are ways to solve them. And we began to characterize the approach to saving particular companies or groups of companies or sectors of companies as what we call a high road approach. In other words, the low road, which we think is an approach which has really emerged in the last 25 years in this country, is where some businesses have become totally focused on the highest return in the shortest amount of time. It's driven by Wall Street. They want to make as much money as they can in the first quarter, second quarter, and they don't have a long-term vision of the company, of the sector. They just want to make a lot of money, and they get out and put that money elsewhere and make more money. I mean, David Roderick, as he dismantled U.S. Steel, said, I'm not in this business to make steel. I'm here to make money. And he dismantled, actually, a relatively healthy company. So we saw that as the low road. We saw the way to solve that problem was not just opposing the low road, which many people are comfortable doing, but saying, well, there could be a high road alternative, which means if you're going to run a company successfully, you need a 10, 15, or 20-year vision. You need to treat your customers and your various stakeholders and shareholders fairly. You need to be transparent. You need to invest in education. And actually investing in education and new technology is risky because it costs money. You make mistakes. It requires patience. You certainly have to make a profit. But you have to make a reasonable profit. What's a reasonable return? And a reasonable return is a return which allows you to invest some of the profits back into the company, into research and development, into human development, into looking for new products and new processes. So when we started, we began principally working for labor and were viewed as only a labor group. But as we began to develop these views of high road development of companies, we began to, in fact, to our surprise initially, and it's no longer a surprise, we found lots of manufacturing companies that really wanted to pursue that approach. And if somebody could provide them with that kind of option, they're ready to get on board. And the fact is, you know, when people speak about corporate America, they speak about, you know, it, when they use it in a word that's in with a negative connotation, they're really thinking about what is a 13,000 publicly traded companies, the very large multinational companies, some of which who have now become known for their predatory practices, where there's 8 million privately held companies that aren't big companies. I mean, most 90% of all manufacturing companies have less than 100 employees. We found that most of these owners really want to do business in the old-fashioned way, which is to us the high road way. They want to be stewards of their industry. They want to make money. But they're open to all the kinds of ideas that we're talking about. So as a result, we've been talking about new ways to save companies, and actually one of the most receptive audiences to that is the manufacturers themselves. And so as a result, we've now been able to create alliances between typically people who fought each other in the past, like the Illinois Manufacturers Association and Illinois AFL-CIO. Historically, would be on separate sides of the table on most issues. Now they're working together with us around a new vision of the state economy. The same thing is happening in Chicago. And we think where you can define a high road way to run a company, that high road businesses and high road owners will want to be involved in it. Same with labor. In labor, you have a high road and a low road. And the high road labor leaders will want to work with high road business owners to make this economy work. So that's the kind of work we do.
What does high road labor, how does it differ from low road labor?
I think the notion of high road, low road applies to businesses, labor, government, community. And the way I define it is I think the low road is where somebody thinks of only their immediate self-interest and solving their particular problem no matter what it costs to somebody else, which means you'll have an owner of a company, they'll make money by destroying the productive capacity of the industry, by destroying the community. I think you can have a labor union that, in fact, has a problem of protecting wages or jobs of its own members, even at the expense of a regional development strategy. Now, again, they have a completely legitimate desire to protect the jobs of their own members. But a high road approach is to look to creative ways to solve the problem of retaining their jobs. So the same is true in government. The low road in government is people who are bureaucratic, don't get in my way. But there's a high road in government. I mean, actually, in Chicago city government now, you see some of the departments that we're working with, like the mayor's office workforce development, to me is a high road department. It's very responsive. It's overcoming bureaucracy. And same with community-based organizations. I mean, you have activist community-based organizations that sometimes will fight for their own members at the expense of their regional economy. Said we'll talk about Walmart. But people are willing sometimes to cut deals that give their very immediate members jobs and benefits, but it's done at the expense of the entire community. So to us, there's a high road and low road in every sector. And we know it's a complex issue, but we try to then identify what are the high road options that is available to everybody and encourage people to go on the high road and to block the low road.
You've gone looking for solutions, at least in part, overseas. What have you found?
Looking overseas has been a very rich experience for us. For example, in Spain in the mid-1950s, in a very depressed area in the Basque region of Spain, a priest with four workers and students who came out of a vocational school bought a small manufacturing company but organized it as a cooperative. where the company was run on the basis of one worker, one vote. The highest paid worker didn't make more than three times the wages of the lowest paid. And the reason for forming this company was to promote community development, not just to make wealth for individual workers. And they had a commitment to high technology. That network of cooperatives bought one company, then they bought another company. They now have 100 companies employing 65,000 people. It's the leading edge of the Spanish industrial economy. It's a market strategy, but it's driven by the values of people who believe in cooperation. These companies are very large. They're in retail and manufacturing. They're very sophisticated. This area is called Mondragon. It's a town in northern Spain. They introduced robotics into the Spanish industrial economy, and most people think in terms of robotics as a low-road approach to get rid of labor. But in this situation, having modern technology meant they could expand market share and hire more people. Northern Italy, the area called Emilia-Romagna, which is actually a sister region with Chicago, is known for having thousands of small companies that actually are both competitors, but they work in cooperation, and they create what is called flexible networks of coming together as a network to bid on even an international project and succeeding in the bid because they're doing things as a group that they couldn't do as individuals. And then for the next project, they reassemble. We've also looked a great deal at the training education systems in Germany and Denmark and found enormous value that can be used in this country. So the international experience to us is something we should understand fully, and our approach is that we should understand best practice and see how our country, our cities can do better in a race to the top.
You mentioned education and training, mm-hmm. and I know that you have just made a proposal to run a high school here in Chicago. Tell me about your proposal and what you intend to do.
The Austin High School is basically closed, and they're now in a process of looking for new alternatives to rebuild the high school in Austin. And when we heard that there's an opportunity to create a school in Austin, we jumped at it. So in the last few weeks, we put together a team and a proposal to create the Austin Polytechnical Academy, which will be a school of 500 students who will receive an education which will allow them to go anywhere. It'll be a high-quality education in terms of reading and math and science. So a student who goes through the school can easily go into any other college or any other career, not including a manufacturing career. But it will have a specific focus and offer the opportunity for kids to go directly into manufacturing. Like I said, Chicago, there's a perception of manufacturing is dead. Well, we actually have 8,000 companies and 400,000 people who still work in manufacturing in Cook County. And like I said, there's 10,500 new jobs that need to be filled every year. And we have companies and organizations like the Tooling Manufacturing Association, Illinois Manufacturers Association, who've now joined with us into the effort to create this new school, who, if a student can reach the standards and has the skill sets, which includes critical thinking, includes working as a team member, as well as knowing calculus and knowing computers, these companies will provide job shadowing opportunities for these kids when they're sophomores. They'll provide internships with them when they're juniors and seniors. But a kid who would graduate from our proposed school would have completed a third of the requirements for getting an apprenticeship in the metal forming industry and to meet what is called the National Institute of Metalworking Skill Standards. They would already have certificates in health and safety. And they would have had jobs and internships and relationships with very specific companies that pay very well and provide careers in the Chicago area. A kid coming out of high school will be able to get a good job, probably paying $40,000 or more because of the education they would receive in this high school. But we're also going to encourage kids to think of not only just working for a company, not only in production, but maybe in research and development or human relations, but also to consider owning a company. Because as I mentioned, a major problem is that we don't have enough young entrepreneurs in our education system who think about owning something.
You mentioned retail earlier, and you mentioned Walmart. I know that you're now looking at modeling this high road approach to retail that you have tackled in manufacturing. Tell me about the high road approach to retail.
Last year and a half, Walmart made a decision to enter and to set up a store in Austin. I mean, everybody knows about Walmart. I mean, there's articles in the Wall Street Journal and Business Week. I mean, this is a company that has a business plan that's totally predatory. Any community that embraces Walmart will be worse off in terms of actual employment and business development 6 years from that time. The evidence is overwhelming that if you recruit a Walmart to come into your community for whatever the reason, your community is going to be worse off. We're committed to community development. So the minute we heard about Walmart coming into Austin, we began to look for alternatives. First of all, we realized that a community does want local access to retail goods, and they want access to retail jobs, and these can be good jobs. So as we looked around the world, and we looked at in Spain, for example, this network of cooperatives that I mentioned, the Mondragon Network, has a retail store. It's called Eroski, and I've actually been in these stores when I was in Spain. And they look like a Walmart, but these are stores that are owned by the workers and consumers in the northern areas of Spain. And these are stores that the highest paid worker doesn't make more than seven times the lowest paid worker compared to the Walton family, which, you know, I mean, five members of the Walton family are worth $20 billion each. I mean, Walmart has pulled $100 billion out of American communities. So we found in Spain, we found in Italy. In Italy, there's Co-op Italia, which is owned by 6 million consumers. They own a store, not just a single family. And they compete in both these situations in Spain and Italy. They've kept Walmart out of their local economies. They provide good retail goods, good retail jobs. They have large scale, but they're organized on a cooperative basis. Even in Canada, you have the Calgary Co-op, which is the second highest retailer in the province. So we're proposing creating a cooperative, large scale retail store to compete with Walmart in the Chicago area and other communities around the country.
One of the complaints about Walmart is the wages paid to the people who manufacture the goods. And yet Americans want access to cheap goods. So how does the cooperative solve the problem of sourcing and sourcing goods that are paying decent wages?
In the first instance, the cooperatives aren't pulling out $100 billion in profit and taking it to what was the town in Arkansas. In other words, the money that's made in terms of the profit margin is generated back into the business and back into consumers. The cooperative stores are very sophisticated. They have equally sophisticated logistic arrangements. I mean, Walmart actually has many strengths to it. I mean, it's been a pioneer and a total innovator in warehousing and transportation. And certainly cooperatives, and actually I think it's very important for the American public to develop a modern view of cooperatives. Cooperatives aren't candles and sandals stores. I mean, are these really low-tech, anti-technology stores. They can be very sophisticated, advanced stores. So for a cooperative like Co-op Italia, first of all, it sources locally wherever it can. Its prices are competitive with stores like Walmart. In other words, it has a different range of goods from low-end to high-end. They source as much as they can locally. But the most important thing is they have a highly motivated workforce. Money isn't being pulled out of that business as profits and income for a particular family. They're rewarded in lots of ways. There's a relationship with local governments in terms of land costs and operations. And so there's lots of variables to running a business. And as we've looked into it, running a competitor to Walmart is a complicated proposition. We have no illusions about that. But we're totally convinced it can be done and done on the basis of a business model.
Is it being done by any of these cooperatives? Are any of them going head-to-head with a Walmart?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, and the Spanish cooperative in the early 90s, they had the same debate. They were actually much smaller then as a cooperative network, and they heard that Walmart, or Carrefour, which is the French equivalent of Walmart, was coming into town, coming to Spain. Many of them got panicky about it and thought they were history. But they actually then responded to the challenge, and they actually began to expand. They began to buy other retail stores and convert them to cooperatives in other parts of Spain and also in parts of France. They began to gain scale, began to gain the efficiencies of the scale, and worked very deliberately and very intentionally to compete with Walmart and to keep them out of the Spanish economy. And so far, they've been successful.
We're out of time. Let me ask you one final question.
Sure.
The labor movement in America clearly is fragmenting.
Right.
It's on the decline. What do you see as the future of the American labor movement?
Well, I actually think the future of the labor movement is a labor movement that really embraces a high road vision of development. I mean, the labor movement, I think, and sometimes wrongly, but has been perceived as an organization as a special interest, only represents the interests of its dues-paying members. Well, first of all, the labor movement has that obligation, just like any association. But I think the labor movement is in a unique position to advance really a different vision of the economy, very much like the vision I'm advancing. And if it does so, I think it'll regain the kind of public support and the kind of enthusiasm it needs to be successful in organizing, you know, particular companies. That, in fact, shift in vision, where it hasn't happened on a national scale, it's a very strong current within the organized labor movement. So, for example, we have a very close working relationship where we have a partnership with the Illinois State AFL-CIO, who embraces many of the things that I'm talking about and is now working with the Illinois Manufacturers Association around a common vision of the economy. The Chicago Federation of Labor is a part of the Chicago Manufacturing Renaissance Council and is working with business organizations and community organizations and educational organizations on these issues. There's a perception that the labor movement is declining, but I think there's a lot of rich debate, a lot of rich discussion, new leaders, a lot of creativity that's beneath the surface in the labor movement that I think I'm confident will break out in a very clear way in the next, you know, few years.
Dan, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks very much. It's my pleasure.
Dan Swinney heads the Center for Labor and Community Research. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about the value of a good street name. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Peter Fisher about his report, Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, we've seen those surveys that suggest that if you have an attractive name, you are more likely to succeed in life. And now there is a group of citizens who feel like their streets would be more successful were they better named.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always put down my achievements in life to my name. Otis is the name that, of course, everyone wants to name their child. But it is true. I mean, what would you rather be known as? Marion Morrison, if you're an actor, or John Wayne, because that was originally John Wayne's name. So we do know that names really do matter. And they matter for people when they buy houses, apparently. In a couple of places, and this is very common, but in a couple of places recently in the Miami suburb of Weston, the neighbors got together and said, we're tired of being known as number streets. Southwest 5th Street, they said, just does not sound like a place where real homeowners live. Sounds like an apartment, they said. So they wanted to name something like Chelsea Circle or Springdale Lane or something like that. So they're asking the city to begin to give real names to the streets that have numbers there. And then sometimes streets and neighborhoods have not numbered names, but real names, but they feel like they need to change them because they've become associated with something bad. In Dallas, they have a neighborhood that's known as the Lower Ferguson Road Corridor. Boy, that doesn't sound nice, does it? And they want to change that. The people who live there want to change it because it has become associated over the years with crime and drugs and so on. And the neighborhood's begun to turn around, and they think to help this turnaround process and to persuade people to come there, we need a really nice name for this neighborhood. So they've gotten some suggestions. Arbor Hills, that sounds pretty good. Lake Forest. Pecan Grove. A more imaginative one is White Rock Urban Village. It's kind of an intriguing name. And then somebody came along and suggested the name Mellow Village. So, how would you like to live in Mellow Village, Carol? Kind of laid back, doesn't it?
It sounds like the 60s all over again to me. Well, good luck to those homeowners that want these more attractive names. Perhaps their homes will go up in value. Otis will talk to you next week.
Okay.
You're listening to Smart City. Peter Fisher is professor in the graduate program in urban and regional planning at the University of Iowa. He is author of Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? With Alan Peters, he co-authored two books that analyzed other economic growth strategies, state enterprise zones, and industrial incentives. Peter Fisher is author of Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? Do you find these various city and state rankings as confusing as I do?
I certainly did at first. I mean, when I started reading about these in the paper, I thought, well, how come Des Moines is the best place in the world 1 week and near the bottom, you know, 3 weeks later on somebody else's ranking? And they're purporting to measure the same thing. So, you know, I started looking into them to find out what made them tick. And it took a lot of digging, but I think I've figured it out.
You look specifically at the rankings that rank or rate business climates. How many groups did you find producing these reports?
Well, there are five ones that I looked at in some detail, and I chose those five because they've gotten a certain amount of publicity and because they have pretty complete information, so I was able to dissect them pretty well. There are another three that I found interesting. They're rather different. They're put out by business magazines, executives, and site location officials. But they're proprietary. They don't tell you much about their methodology or data sources for the most part. So I have some comments about them, but I wasn't able to really dissect them.
Mm-hmm. Well, who wins a contest, Peter, depends on the rules you play by. Who wins these rankings depends on what you're measuring. What are these groups measuring?
Well, oftentimes not what it seems they're measuring. For example, the Small Business Survival Index, from the title you would think would be measuring how well the state's environment nurtures small businesses. Now, there's state entrepreneurship programs and business loan programs and whatnot. But when you get into it, you discover that it actually is measuring income taxes on high-income individuals and not much else. And that's what really drives whether one state does well and another one doesn't. If it's a part at all of what matters to small business survival, it's only a small part. Cato's fiscal policy report card is another one where you think would be, you know, how well do they balance the budget and keep revenues and expenditures in line, and they have a good bond rating, but it proves not to be really much about that.
What is it about?
Well, it's mostly about how well the state conforms to the Cato Institute's agenda of limited government. It's all about tax cutting. It's all about keeping revenues down. So it doesn't matter to them what you spend it on, whether it's wasteful or not. Less is always better when it comes to spending and taxes. Tax cuts are always good, even if they're a giveaway to, you know, some special interest group. So it's not really fiscal responsibility. It's limited government that they're measuring or attempting to measure.
You point out that 34 of the 50 states can claim that they're in the top 10 in terms of business climate or competitiveness. They just have to pick which of the five indexes they want to point to. In fact, you don't have much nice to say about any of these indexes. Run through them quickly and tell me generally where their reasoning is faulty.
Yeah, I just talked about the Small Business Survival Index. You know, I think the thing that really drives that is antipathy for taxes on high-income individuals. And there's a lot of things, actually, that states do to support small business growth and the development of entrepreneurs, which is important. Because their expenditure programs, they're ignored by this index. So, you know, I think it's clearly an ideology that's driving what goes into it. The State Business Tax Climate Index. Now, this is narrower than the others. It's not focusing on overall business climate, just business taxes. The problem we found with that one is that instead of trying to measure what businesses are actually going to end up paying if they build a new facility in State X or City Y, they come up with all these numbers and rankings that are then added together, and it turns out that what you end up with has very little to do with actual business tax burdens. And, you know, we do some comparisons with better measures of business taxes, and there's almost no relationship between what the Tax Foundation comes up with and what would be a reasonable estimate of business taxes. Beacon Hill's competitiveness report is clearly about overall competitiveness. The problem here is that they include just a whole range of variables and then try to prove that their index, in fact, tells you which states are going to do well and which ones don't. But some of their variables, like internet connections per capita or, you know, infant mortality rates, et cetera, aren't causes of economic growth. They're results of prosperity or lack of prosperity. And, you know, it's really, they mix up things that have to do with competitiveness and things that have to do with the results of an economy. And so it ends up being pretty worthless as a guide to policy. And then the last one that I haven't mentioned, I talked a little bit about the Cato Institute, but the Economic Freedom Index is put out by a libertarian group, and it is pretty much just a checklist of policies and regulations that libertarians hate or love, depending on, you know, whether it enters plus or minus. And many of them really have nothing to do with economic growth. In fact, the majority probably have very little to do with economic growth. For example, the Attorney General's salary, whether you allow 12-year-olds to have driver's licenses, seatbelt laws, and continuing education requirements for nurses, just to give you a flavor of the kinds of things that are in here.
Well, that's an interesting array of items to rank.
Yes.
You mentioned the Beacon Hill study. You pointed out that researchers confused factors that cause economic growth and factors that are outcomes of economic growth. And that happens a lot. Explain the difference and how they can be confused.
Sure. I mean, some of these are just measures of growth. For example, employer firm births, so the number of new firms that arise in a state. Now, that is growth itself. It's a measure of growth. It's not predicting. It's like saying if more firms are born in your state, you're going to have more firms. That's kind of circular reasoning. Or bank deposits per capita. Now, if the state is prosperous, people are going to have a lot of money, and they'll have a lot of money in the bank. So saying that a state with lots of deposits per capita is going to grow is not accurate. Saying that it probably already has grown, and that's why people have a lot of money, would be more accurate.
What do you think the factors are that indeed cause economic growth? What should be measured?
Well, there's been quite a bit of research on this for several decades, really. We have a pretty good idea of what things are important. And they include labor costs, labor education and productivity in particular is increasingly important. Things like energy costs, transportation. Do you have an airport nearby with good connections? A hub would be preferable. Quality of elementary and secondary schools. People that locate are going to be attracted to a community, want to know how well their children are to be educated. Healthcare costs, and even cultural and recreational amenities. If you're trying to attract particularly a more skilled labor force, those things become important.
Do you typically find those things in these rankings?
Well, interestingly, you don't find them very much. You find a few of them here and there in these indexes. What you're more likely to find is taxes. But when you look at these indexes, for example, put out by Forbes magazine or Expansion Management, that are aimed at not at state legislators, which is what I think the other indexes are aimed at, but these are aimed at the people who are actually making the decisions. They include these kinds of factors, maybe not all of them, but Forbes, for example, which just came out with a new best places ranking in the last couple of days, includes the cost of doing business, includes educational attainment, the cost of living, the crime rate, a culture and leisure index, and Expansion Magazine's indexes include health care, a quality of life quotient, and an education quotient. So, these indexes that are aimed at people who are actually going to be deciding whether a firm builds a new plant and where tend to have a broader view and a more accurate index or assessment in terms of the factors that really matter.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Peter Fisher. He is professor in the graduate program in urban and regional planning at the University of Iowa and author of Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? Peter, are these rankings then meaningless?
Well, I think they should be for the most part. I think, unfortunately, they're not taken as meaningless. And I think by putting them out there, that the hope of these organizations really is that they will become arguments in a debate over public policy. It's something that a lobbyist or a legislator who shares their view of what government ought to be doing can wave around and say, look, we're ranking poorly on business climate. We need to do something about it. And the prescription that comes out of these reports is cut taxes, cut government spending, and your state will grow. So, are they meaningless? They probably are, but they're not irrelevant because they can become, a weapon in this debate over public policy.
I know you didn't study these in detail, but you mentioned that both Forbes and Expansion Management used a quality of life measure in their rankings. Again, I know these are proprietary indexes, but I'm wondering if you know how they calculated quality of life.
In the case of Forbes, I don't, because they actually rely on something else. The Culture and Leisure Index from Sperling's Best Places. So we have an example of one index, including somebody else's index as one of their components. But if you look at the Expansion Management magazine, there's a variety of things that go into it. Cost of living is one, particularly housing. Annual pay of workers, crime rates. A number of these indexes do incorporate crime statistics because they're easy to come by.
Mm-hmm.
But things like traffic congestion and various measures of the education of the population.
So that all wraps up into this quality of life quotient you mentioned.
Right. And the Culture and Leisure Index, I guess we know a little bit about that. That was in part of Forbes' Best Places ranking. I see that's some measured, I don't know, where do they get these statistics? Museums, theaters, golf courses, sports teams, and other facilities per capita, or, you know, some kind of measure of those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that many of the rankings you looked at in detail really have a bias about low taxes. One of the ongoing challenges in public policy today is this creation of exceptions to the rules, tax breaks for certain businesses but not for others. So we mm-hmm. have a tax system, and then we have exceptions to the tax system that we use to attract business to a particular place or to grow, et cetera. And the use of those tax breaks seems to be growing. Is there a way to rationalize this activity to get the businesses we want and at the same time be fair to all businesses?
That's difficult, and that's a really good question. It's surprising to me that the fairness issue, in fact, isn't raised more often, because you certainly do create competitive advantages for some particular firms and therefore disadvantages often for long-time firms that have been, you know, stable employers in your state, and you're undercutting them to a degree by offering incentives to new firms. You know, I think in general these kinds of strategies are much more costly than they appear, and I know public officials like to talk about all the investment that they're leveraging, because they gave, you know, $1 million in incentives and got $10 million of new investment. And in a way, I wonder who's leveraging whom. In a lot of instances, firms will pretty much decide where they want to locate based on real economic factors, access to suppliers and labor markets, et cetera. And then they'll see how much they can leverage in terms of local incentives, playing one place off against another. And in that case, the public officials are giving away money they didn't need to. It continues because the businesses hold all the cards. They're the ones that know the real locational choices and what they hinge on. And the public officials are just guessing, and too often they're unwilling to risk, quote, losing a business. They provide a lot more than they needed to in incentives.
I think that should be your next study, Peter.
Well, actually, my colleague and I, Alan Peters, have been looking at that question of the efficacy of incentives for some time. And I think the conclusion is pretty clear. It's not that they never work. It's that they are the decisive factor in a small share of cases and therefore end up being a very expensive way to try to grow your economy.
Mm-hmm. We have so much experience with these tax exceptions now. Don't we have enough knowledge now to fix the existing system, if there's something wrong with the existing system, and create a tax system that works for everyone and yet produces the outcomes we're looking for? Or, you know, do all the governors need to hold hands and jump in the water together?
Well, yes, a lot of people have talked about, you know, how do you get a truce in this sort of economic war among the states, and it's difficult. And that's the most common response I hear, is that, well, we don't like doing this, but everybody else is doing it, so that we have to too. You know, that's the cost of being, they probably have some sports analogy, in the game or something. But, you know, you got to pay to play.
Yeah, there you go. That's good. It's football season.
And, of course, the economists would reply with their own sports analogy of leveling the playing field, which means, look, just create a basic, even-handed business tax system and stick with it. And then, you know, raise revenues and spend it the way state governments and local governments are supposed to, on the things that government do and have to do, on their schools and their roads and their sewer and water systems, and just worry about efficient government, and the economy will take care of itself, because your state has some economic advantages and economic disadvantages, and that's going to drive in the long run what kind of an economy you have.
The next time one of these rankings is announced, what questions should we ask to determine its usefulness?
Well, I think one thing you should ask is it measuring what it claims to measure? Is it based on research, or is it just somebody's kind of checklist of, you know, things that they thought of one day on the back of an envelope, or what's more likely, a checklist of policies or programs that they like or don't like? And then go down the list of what's included, and, you know, does this make sense? Does it make sense to sort of just add all these things together? And to be honest, I'm not sure that the whole enterprise of trying to rank places on business climate is worth doing in the first place. The problem is that, you know, rankings are news, and whenever your city or your state gets ranked high or low, it makes the papers. And these folks are taking advantage of that, and most people are not, you know, equipped really to critically evaluate these indexes. But, you know, I think we're better off without them.
Peter, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Glad to do it.
Peter Fisher is author of Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? You're listening to Smart City. City View's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
The irony of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita is that the intensity with which they bore down on the oil facilities of Louisiana and Texas was due in some part, meteorologists say, to the global warming of the Gulf created by the fossil fuel consumption fed by those very rigs and refineries. It's almost as if Mother Nature was trying to purge herself of an affliction, using hurricanes as her immune response. Now, admittedly, this is a stretch, but the irony is still undeniable. In fact, much of the devastation and losses from these hurricanes is the result of our collective indifference to jeopardy and immoderation. We're aware of the inevitable consequences of cheap gas and beachfront developments. Yet not only do we ignore the inevitable, we flout it. And let me be clear, I mean me too. I own a beach house 5 hours from where I live that takes a tank of gas to get to. It's just that Katrina and Rita have gotten me thinking about the folly of our approach to the future. Not that we ignore the future completely. We've built levees, dams, seawalls, and jetties. We've stockpiled a strategic oil reserve. We've developed plans for evacuations and disaster relief. We've set fuel economy standards, and many cities have committed to the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, notwithstanding our lack of action at a national level. But these efforts, though commendable, fall short because we don't want to do more. The incentives aren't there. This is where the free market can help. The free market is the most efficient way of organizing our collective behaviors because, given the freedom to do so, we will voluntarily undertake whatever yields us the greatest rewards. When the incentives are right and we have the freedom, the market leads to the best outcome. What we need are free market incentives that align our decisions today with the predictable risk of tomorrow. What this takes is a recognition that the market is free not because it operates without rules, but because people are free to operate however they choose within a set of rules. Indeed, today's free market is bounded by many rules that restrict things like monopolies, predatory pricing, insider trading, deceptive accounting, false advertising, and unsafe products. The best rules, though, are not regulatory penalties, but economic and tax incentives. In the free market, the carrot works better than the stick. Already, we have seen this work in things like the control of air pollution, which is now better than ever because free market incentives have been put in place to motivate companies to do what's best in the long run. We should think carefully about how we want to rebuild the areas affected by Katrina and Rita. Investing wisely now could spare everyone further tragedy and greater expenses in the future. It's said that freedom isn't free, and neither is the free market. What we need right away are free market incentives to motivate us to live without the excesses that put us in harm's way. For City Views, This is Walker Smith.
City Views commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities. Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.